Welcome to Emerging Experts. I'm your host, Jordan Zava. In this episode, we are joined by Paolo Tarantino, research fellow at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, for a conversation on HER2-low breast cancer. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Tarantino. To start, would you mind telling us a little bit about you?
Of course. I'm Paolo Tarantino, a breast medical oncologist, right now an advanced research fellow at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Harvard Medical School. And I mostly focus my research on the HER2 space of breast cancer and on novel antibody drug conjugates. So happy to be with you today.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again for joining. And can you share what kind of inspired you to specialize in breast cancer research and what led you to focus on HER2 and antibody drug conjugates?
Yeah, of course. Mostly I've been struck by the huge unmet need represented by breast cancer. You know, it's such an incident and prevalent disease for which there's still so much more that needs to be done. And it's also a tricky disease. It's not an easy one to handle. You often have late recurrences. You often have treatment resistance, and many patients receive sequential lines of chemotherapies. But just recognize that this was really an opportunity to, first of all, improve outcomes for a large percentage of cancer patients working in breast oncology, but also to try to unveil some of the mysteries of this disease of breast cancer. And the opportunity came from my oncology training that was in Milan in Italy, and I was working phase one trials, and I had the luck of working on one of the phase one trials that really kind of reshaped the way we treat breast cancer. That was the one of trastuzumab deruxtecan, an antibody drug conjugate, and seeing that every patient that we would treat with these antibody drug conjugates was experiencing a prolonged response to this novel agent, which is not something too common in phase one trials. You do have successes, but you also have many failures. And so seeing this profound success really drove my interest in antibody drug conjugates, HER2 in general, and of course, breast oncology.
Definitely. That's a wonderful answer. And obviously, HER2-low breast cancer has been a topic of significant research interest. Can you explain the challenges in defining HER2-low breast cancer and how it differs from HER2-positive and HER2-negative subtypes?
Yes, going back to when I first worked on this agent, trastuzumab deruxtecan, back in 2018, we had a trial for HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, and the drug worked amazingly. But then I realized there was an abstract presented of this drug working also in HER2-low breast cancer. And back then in 2018, HER2-low still didn't have a clear meaning, a clear definition. And then what happened is that after the phase one data, we saw in 2022, DESTINY-Breast04, a phase three trial that clearly established that trastuzumab deruxtecan worked better than traditional chemotherapy for HER2-low metastatic breast cancer. And that further ignited my interest in this category, and also to study the kind of discrepancies and challenges with diagnosing HER2-low breast cancer. We conducted a study looking at how HER2-low evolves as a biomarker between primary breast cancer and metastatic breast cancer, and there's wide discrepancy between these two time points. And then we looked at other discrepancies. We looked at the genomics of HER2-low. Basically, what we realized is that the current definition of HER2-low based on immunohistochemistry 1+ or 2+ non-amplified, is really imperfect, mostly because immunohistochemistry was never fine-tuned to define HER2-low. It was fine-tuned to define HER2-positive. And so we now utilize it for defining HER2-low, but we have already seen from another trial, DESTINY-Breast06, that even patients with HER2-0 disease can benefit from T-DXd significantly, with a response rate of 60%, a PFS of 13 months on a median. And so I think that we really are realizing that we need novel ways to look at HER2, quantitative ways, and we hope to present soon some of the first data with quantitative assays predicting the activity of T-DXd. But for the moment, it's important to remember that HER2-low defined with immunohistochemistry is still the best way that we have in clinical practice to find patients that can benefit from T-DXd. And this is why we still kind of recommend and discuss that it's important to focus on this biomarker And now also expanded to this ultra low category. That means patients that have HER2 zero disease, but for which still the pathologists can find some minimal staining of HER2 on the HER2 slide.
That's a wonderful answer. Thank you for delving into that. And what are the current diagnostic techniques used to identify HER2 low breast cancer, and how accurate are they?
So yes, we commonly utilize immunohistochemistry. This is the first test that is commonly utilized to understand if a tumor is HER2 zero, HER2 low, HER2 positive. If the immunohistochemical score is 3+, the tumor is positive. If it's zero, it's zero. If it's 1+, it's low. If it's 2+, it requires a reflex FISH testing that looks at the HER2 amplification. And if there is an amplification, we call it positive. If it's there is no amplification, that is most of the cases, we call it HER2 low. And in truth, as I was mentioning, the sensitivity for HER2 low with immunohistochemistry is really not perfect. We know that there are many cases that are read as HER2 zero, but actually could be defined HER2 low by a different pathologist. And we know in general that the her immunohistochemistry is not the most sensitive assay that we could utilize. And so there's a new whole world of novel quantitative assays, including RPPA, that is a proteomic assay, or quantitative immunofluorescence, or even assays that look at the mRNA of HER2 that could help to quantify HER2. And all of these are still experimental, but I do think that in the future, some of these may play a role to quantify HER2 in clinical practice.
Definitely. Thank you for that. And in your experience, how does the treatment approach differ for patients with HER2 low breast cancer compared with other subtypes?
So yes, it's important to remember that patients with HER2 positive breast cancer are treated in a very distinct manner with many anti-HER2 drugs that have proven to be efficacious. Then you have the majority of patients that we call HER2 negative that are further divided into HER2 low and zero. And so if they are HER2 low, if they have IHC 1+ or 2+ non-amplified, we know that we have an agent that is approved and improves overall survival for these patients. That is trastuzumab deruxtecan, and we can utilize it if the patient is metastatic and has progressed on at least one line of chemotherapy. We know that another trial, DESTINY-Breast06, showed benefit not only in patients with HER2 low, but also HER2 zero ultra low disease, some with minimal expression of HER2, where T-DXd had a longer PFS compared to chemotherapy. And so we still don't have an indication, or NCCN still doesn't recommend treating patients with zero ultra low disease with T-DXd. But we see this coming just because the benefit was so striking that in the future, not only patients with HER2 positive breast cancer, not only patients with HER2 low, but maybe also ultra low disease may benefit and may receive in clinical practice trastuzumab deruxtecan to improve their outcomes.
Yes, that's a great answer. And kind of off of T-DXd a little bit, antibody drug conjugates have shown promise in treating various cancers. Could you explain how ADCs work and their potential advantages over traditional chemotherapy?
So yes, ADCs build on 50 years of development of chemotherapies and on even like 40, 30 to 40 years of development of antibody drug conjugates, meaning linking chemotherapy molecules to an antibody through a molecular linker. And the idea originally is to kind of deliver precisely the chemotherapy into the tumor. And so you inject this complex of the antibody bound to the chemotherapy in the body. The antibody reaches the tumor, binds to the epitope that it targets on the cancer cell. It gets internalized and delivers the chemotherapy precisely. This is the ideal mechanism of action, and we know that this happens. We have abundant preclinical and also clinical evidence of this occurring, but we are learning that there's also other layers of activity of ADCs. ADCs can also reactivate anti-tumor immunity through the Fc portion of the ADC. And also, ADCs have a prolonged kinetic that allows for a prolonged delivery of chemotherapy. And so, in truth, we have many different layers of activity that make ADCs just smarter and more effective chemotherapies. They still come with some side effects of chemotherapy that we're trying to mitigate and minimize in clinical practice, but they definitely showed in many instances to be more active than unconjugated chemotherapy.
Excellent. And what are some of the recent advances in ADCs that you find most exciting, particularly in the context of breast cancer?
So in truth, I find really exciting, first of all, to have many agents available because this allows for tailoring treatments for our patients. And so we have already three ADCs approved in general for breast cancer, and these are trastuzumab emtansine, T-DM1, sacituzumab govitecan, or trastuzumab deruxtecan, T-DXd. There is another ADC that showed activity, Dato-DXd, daropotamab deruxtecan, that is also more active than chemotherapy and may be approved soon. And there is a very broad array of ADCs being developed. And so in truth, having more options will allow in the future to target our treatments. But in truth, I feel that besides this, we also need better biomarkers. And so what we are doing at Dana-Farber, we are trying to collect as many tissue and plasma samples from patients that have received T-DXd in clinical practice to learn from these samples as much as possible. And so we profile them with cutting-edge technologies for looking at proteomics, genomics, transcriptomics, and also with liquid biopsy assays to understand, first of all, if there's a new assay that can predict the activity of these ADCs in a fine manner, and also to understand what happens at the tumor that is exposed to the ADC. And so we compare tissue and plasma samples before and after the ADCs, and all of this is work ongoing. And I do feel that all of this in the future hopefully will help to fine-tune and to better tailor treatments for our patients. And then there is a whole new generation of ADCs in preparation. ADCs that utilize bispecific or trispecific antibodies that have more stable site-specific linkers and that deliver not only chemotherapy, but that can also deliver other molecules, such as radioactive isotopes that can deliver PROTACs, meaning protein degraders, or can deliver targeted therapies or immunogenic molecules. All of this is still in early phase testing, but I feel there is a whole new generation of ADCs coming, and some of this will hopefully help our patients.
That's a really wonderful answer. And off of that, can you discuss any ongoing or recent clinical trials involving ADCs that you're involved in, or what have some preliminary results been observed?
So I will mention three key clinical trials that I helped to develop at Dana-Farber since I joined. And these are dubbed SATIN, Database, and TRuDy. So SATIN is basically trying to answer what to do after T-DXd in HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer. And we are testing sacituzumab govitecan after T-DXd. This is the first trial that tests sacituzumab govitecan in HER2 positive disease, and we hope to present data in the years to come. Database try to answer a very different question. So we know that Dato-DXd is highly active in hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer. We have good data in triple-negative breast cancer, but we still don't have much data in patients with active brain metastasis. And so Database will only enroll patients with active brain metastasis and leptomeningeal disease. There is a high unmet need population, and it's also ongoing and enrolling. And finally, TRuDy takes an ADC trastuzumab deruxtecan with immunotherapy to one of the most aggressive breast cancer subtypes, that is the inflammatory breast cancer. And so we will treat patients with inflammatory breast cancer with neoadjuvant T-DXd durvalumab and see either with HER2 positive or HER2 low disease. And the trial is already ongoing, and we do hope also in the next years to show some outcome data with this combination, for which we are very excited. We already saw some data in a metastatic setting. So all of this is ongoing, and I had the fortune of participating to this at Dana-Farber. So please stay tuned, and we'll hopefully show some data soon.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. And looking ahead, what do you see as the biggest challenges and opportunities in the field of HER2-targeted therapies and ADCs?
So for sure, the major challenge is the sequencing of ADCs, because we still don't have enough data to understand if they work after each other and how best to sequence them. And so there has been real-world data suggesting that the second ADC may have impaired activity compared to the first one. And so I think we really need to study this deeper on a prospective manner. And we will do this with another trial, TRADE-DXd, and other trials that are ongoing. And this will for sure be a challenge. And a second important challenge is toxicities. We really need to figure out why some patients tolerate ADCs extremely well, whereas some other patients develop interstitial lung disease or febrile neutropenia or other life-threatening toxicities. And so all of these are challenges, but I think we really have the technologies to kind of understand better how to sequence ADCs, how to predict toxicity up front, and try to optimize the dose of these ADCs. And so I do feel that there is a lot going on. There is a lot of opportunities to tailor our treatments better. It just unfortunately takes time. And so all clinical trials take time to be developed, to activate, to enroll, to show data, and to be studied further. But I do feel that the next 5 years will really be key. First of all, to understand ADC sequencing, to understand how to implement novel ADCs, but also to optimize the side effect profile of these ADCs. Because the ultimate goal is to only hit the tumor without hitting the patient, the healthy tissues. We partially got there, but still not fully got there. And so I think we have a way to go, but the next 5 years will be key. And I think a lot will be learned. And hopefully, our patients will benefit from all the developments from the next 5 years.
That is excellent. Thank you. And in the field as a whole, are there any emerging technologies or approaches that you believe have the potential to revolutionize the treatment of breast cancer?
So first of all, I think combinations will be key. And so we're already seeing that in some settings, combining ADCs with immunotherapy can be very effective. We saw it, for instance, in the BEGONIA trial that showed very high response rate with either Dato-DXd durvalumab or with T-DXd durvalumab. So that's one hot field. Novel endocrine treatments. So for a long while, we haven't been combining endocrine treatment with chemotherapy, but now we're starting to rethink this now that we have novel endocrine treatments available, and of course, targeted treatments and much more. And also combining ADCs. We recently saw the first trial combining two different ADCs for urothelial cancer, showing very high response rates. And I feel that soon this will be also tested in breast oncology. And if we find the right doses, right schedules, maybe we can benefit from combining ADCs. And then finally, taking these drugs to the early stage setting may help to cure patients. And so that's the ultimate goal, to prevent recurrences, to cure patients from breast cancer. And all of that is ongoing right now. But also there, I feel we will need biomarkers. And so, for instance, one biomarker that has shown to be very promising is called HER2-DX. This looks at tumors on a comprehensive molecular manner, looking at the HER2 expression, expression of luminal, proliferative, and immunogenic signatures, and trying to understand what is the likelihood of achieving a complete response, the likelihood of recurrence of the tumor. And mostly that's for the moment validated in HER2 positive breast cancer. But I think there's an opportunity to look molecularly at tumors in a comprehensive way, just like HER2-DX does for HER2 positive breast cancer. And in that way, tailor our treatments, utilize the best treatments at the best moment for the right patients, and to really try to optimize outcomes, prevent recurrence, but also minimize side effects. So I think all of this is converging together with other biomarker that I still have to mention, circulating tumor DNA. So liquid biopsy also extremely promising to monitor molecular residual, the minimal residual disease, and understand the molecular evolution of cancer. And so I do feel that once again, the next 5 years we'll see the convergence of new drugs, new assays, both on tissue but also in plasma. And hopefully this convergence will allow us to tailor our treatments and to be finer in the way we treat cancer and we cure patients with breast cancer.
That's really great. It'll be very exciting to see what comes from all of this research and data. But obviously, personalized medicine is becoming increasingly important in oncology. How do you see the role of personalized approaches evolving in the management of breast cancer, particularly in relation to HER2 low and ADC treatments?
So yes, it's extremely important to remember that the one of our aims, one of the main aims, is to treat patients in a personalized manner. And we're already doing that in terms of looking at the genomics of the tumor. We do ctDNA and tissue NGS to understand the genomics. We do also immunohistochemistry to understand and dissect HER2 low from zero and to treat the right patients with ADCs. But in truth, I think we also have to move beyond that and remember that, of course, being oncologists, clinicians, we always have to take into account the clinical features of the patients. So where the disease has spread and what are the clinical features of the patient age, the patient clinical features in general, but also preferences. And so I feel the ultimate goal of personalizing treatments will be, of course, to look at the tumor genomics, protein expression of ADC targets, looking at the clinical features of the tumors and the patients, but finally also providing the patient with options that can be also further personalized based on the preferences of the patients. And so one patient we may prefer to receive an ADC upfront, other patient may prefer to receive first oral chemotherapy or another line of endocrine treatment. And I think it's important to remember and to provide these kind of options backed by all the data that can help to make an informed discussion, an informed decision, and of course, informed by the best assays that can really predict the activity of all of these compounds, and also in the future, hopefully predict the toxicity. So all of this will, I think, will converge and will help us to discuss the data with the patients and to make together an informed decision at each point of the treatment path.
Definitely, that's excellent. And from a clinician's perspective, what do you believe are the most important considerations when treating patients with breast cancer, especially those with the HER2 low subtype?
So right now, HER2 low is mostly utilized in the metastatic setting. So when we look at a patient that has metastatic breast cancer, still the most important features remain the hormone receptor status of the disease and the HER2 status, instead if the tumor is positive, low, or zero. These remain key to understand how to treat the tumor. And then, of course, upon this, we put several layers of clinical and molecular features. It's important to remember that the sites of disease are extremely important to kind of predict the prognosis and also to understand which treatment can be most beneficial. And so we know that tumors that have spread only to bone or not visceral organs like lymph nodes usually have a better prognosis compared to visceral involvement or even involvement of the central nervous system that harbors a different prognosis and requires dedicated treatment. And then, of course, patient age and patient preferences are extremely important to understand when to utilize different treatments. And then, of course, the time on prior treatments. We know that a patient that benefited for longer from endocrine treatment maybe can benefit again from another endocrine treatment, especially if we find some molecular features like ESR1 mutations or others that predict endocrine response. And instead, for tumors that have short response of endocrine treatment, maybe something like chemotherapy or an ADC like trastuzumab deruxtecan can be beneficial, particularly for HER2 low disease. So it's a, let's say it's a scenario that is getting more and more complex, but it's a complexity that is welcome because it really allow us to treat patients better, to tailor treatments better, and to allow us to really utilize the different treatments that are becoming available in the right moment for the right patient.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And obviously, you have a significant presence on social media. What kind of inspired you to use these platforms and share your research and insights with the broader community?
So I was originally mandated by my boss, Paolo, make a Twitter account. And he was totally right back then. I couldn't understand the reasons back then because I feel that Twitter, now known as X, is not probably the most appealing social media immediately. But once you start again, like getting deeper into it and seeing all the information, all the novelty that is into it, all the people spreading their ideas and novel that scientific data, you just realize rapidly what a key social media it is, what a key opportunity it is, first of all, to shape opinions and ideas, to remain updated and to network. It's so important. I met so many brilliant people, so many people that had an impact both on my scientific understanding of oncology, but also in general on my career. You can meet mentors, you can meet collaborators on social media, on Twitter. And so I really felt that in the last basically 5 years that I've been on Twitter, this really had a major impact on my career and life. And I really look forward to keeping on remaining on this platform and all like social media platform. There's many others that can be helpful, like LinkedIn or even some others that are probably less utilized for social purposes, at least in the US, but are utilized elsewhere, like Facebook or Instagram. All of these can really help. Of course, they also come with challenges and they need to be utilized in a wise manner in order not to waste time on them, in order to not be misinformed by them. But I think the opportunity that comes with being on this social media really calls for trying to engage with them and trying to leverage them in order to promote our scientific understanding, our scientific knowledge, and also our ability to network with peers.
Definitely. And how do you think social media is changing the landscape of medical education and oncology research dissemination?
I feel, you know, social media is really allowing scientific information to move so much faster than it ever did in the past. And so whenever you have a new presentation at a congress, or whenever you have some new data coming out being published, you immediately see some comments from some of the people you respect the most in your field. And so instead of having to wait for an editorial to be published or for a review article, you can have immediately, in a few minutes, opinions on everything that are usually very short, because, for instance, Twitter requires comments to be short. And so they really go straight to the message. And this allows information to gain an unprecedented speed and to allow also you to kind of capture information much faster. And this also comes with challenges, because science also requires to go deep in the data to understand it to the fullest. But I think it is important to kind of first understand where science is moving and then deciding where to go deeper. And I do feel that this allows to spark interest, to shape research interest, and to build collaborations, and also to understand where things are going. So personally, I feel things are moving very fast. It's not always easy to keep track with all of this, especially on social media, but it is worth it. It's worth to be on social media. It is worth to follow the science, and it's important, I feel, to follow the right people. So the people that you feel connected with, the people you feel inspired by, those are the people that you want to follow, you want to hear the voice of, and you want to also connect with. So we should never be afraid of reaching out to a person that we admire, or from whom we think we can learn something, or we can partner with, and social media allow for that. So I really recommend everybody to be on Twitter and other social medias as well.
Yeah, that's a really great answer. And what advice would you give to other medical professionals considering building their social media presence to share their work and connect with the broader medical community?
So the best answer is always, to listen. To be, and in this case, probably is more to read, meaning that the best way to learn how to tweet, the best way to learn how to convey messages in a clear and also in a manner that does not, hurt anybody, in a manner that is respectful, is just to see the people that have been doing it for a while and for which this worked. And I do feel like in the beginning, I learned so much by following the right people, and also, reaching out to them and trying to learn from them. At the same time, I feel after understanding how things are happening on Twitter, not being afraid of showing and like spreading your ideas. I feel this platform are made for people to share ideas, and everybody should feel comfortable to share their ideas in a respectful manner. And I feel that's the moment where you really are using the social media in the best ways. When you learn from them, but when you also teach, when you also provide your feedback, your view on things, and that's when the social media provide their best, because they allow to learn, to teach, to connect, to network, and they become such a valuable and helpful resource to do all this in science.
Wonderful. Well, you shared some really great answers and very comprehensive insights, so thank you so much. Is there anything else regarding your own work or the breast cancer field as a whole that you would like to share with our audience?
I will just close by saying that I had amazing mentors. I was so lucky to have Giuseppe Corigliano and Sara Tolani as mentors. And I really felt that in my career, that helped so much to understand where the most meaningful things were, how to reach my goals, and where to look at in order to improve outcomes for patients and improve also, of course, my career path. And so the thing I would recommend to everybody is to find the right mentor. It's not always easy, but there is resources, there is ways. They are promoted also by scientific organizations, by ESMO, ASCO, AACR. And so I really feel that that can help to kind of filter your ideas, your understanding, your passions, and guide you through how to make those passions into actual studies, in actual data, in actual things that can help the patients and advance your career. So a right mentor can make so much for you as a, as a person, as a scientist, as an oncologist, and I recommend anybody to strive to look for that. And there is ways, and if anybody has any questions, any need, just feel free to reach out to me, and I'm happy, I'm happy either to mentor or to connect with potential mentors that may help advance in your careers.
For more updates on the latest news and trends in oncology, be sure to visit www.targetedonc.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. You can also find us across social media platforms. Follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Targeted Onc, and on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Targeted Oncology. See you next time.